The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Space Show. And this is a special time for our Tuesday program, so we appreciate your tuning in a lot earlier than Tuesday evening. It is well worth it, and we know you're going to enjoy our program very much. A couple of very quick announcements, and then I will introduce you to our guest. For those of you that would like to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Which is a toll-free number in the States. If you're outside the United States and you want to call the show, if you email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, I will send you back the direct dial number, because I'm not sure you can call toll-free from a lot of different countries. So again, our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. You can also reach us by email, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And then also you can post a comment on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right side is the upcoming show menu bar. And we're the first show listed. So you open that up, which it happens to be our archive program for today as well. And then comments are down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your question or your comment, I will get it and can bring it up on air. Again, the toll-free number is our preferred way, 1-866-687-7223. Do go to our website because we do have our newsletter up and running for the week, and a couple of announcements about that. So let me start with that. So Sunday, there is no show as I'm scheduled to go to Orlando for the AIAA meetings, but all of this is up in the air due to Hurricane Irma, and I won't know if I'm making that trip until Thursday or Friday of this week. But as it now stands, I will not be here next week, and travel day is Sunday, and I will not be doing a live show on Sunday either. So keep looking at the website, and I will post comments and make some changes if Hurricane Irma forces a cancellation of that trip. Everything we do is archived, and so you can quickly listen to shows right off of our website or download them. The website newsletter is up and running, and it shows everything we have planned for the week in detail. Plus, it also has all of the events planned, and we're booking toward the end of the year now. So we do have a lot of shows on the schedule there for you to check out. Guest suggestions are always welcome. There's a store in the upper left menu, and that is under support if you're interested in spatial logo wear and things of that nature. There's also a listen live button, and remember, it tells you how to listen to live shows, podcast shows, archive shows, and if you're using Alexa, you can listen to Alexa formatted shows using the embedded player TuneIn, which is also on that site. And then the most important button to me is support the Space Show, so you'll see it over on the center right. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, then you do get a tax deduction for your contribution to the Space Show. The same is true in California, and your support is what keeps us on the air. So we are very appreciative of those of you who do support us. Do visit our parent, which is the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and that is the 501c3. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me. You'll also see a huge button for Amazon in our center of our page, and that's because Amazon has two really great programs for supporting nonprofits. If you click on that link, you'll see both of the programs and how they're used for the Space Show. If you have any questions using them, don't hesitate to email me again, Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. We do also have corporate sponsors, and they have banner ads going across our homepage, so do check out what's underneath those banner ads from time to time. For the first segment of today's program, we have a couple of sponsors bringing you that segment, and the New Worlds Conference is one of them. It is November 10th through the 11th in Austin, Texas, and their website is newworlds2017.space. So check it out. It's a great conference, and if you go, please let me know so I can get a report from you. The Integrated Space Plan is also a sponsor, and this is their detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. Their plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by the base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their website, where all of this is available, is thespaceplan.com. Their space website version of the Integrated Space Plan is interactive. If you click on any of the 500 elements, you get a lot more information. But you can buy a full-size poster of the plan. Very inspiring. Also, they have an Integrated Space Plan for children. So view it all and get your poster plan at thespaceplan.com. And then finally, for the first segment, the Space Foundation is our sponsor. The event they had in San Francisco was terrific last week. We'll have a lot of guests coming on the program that were speakers at that conference. It was well worth it. And you'll get some of the benefits of that. But their 34th symposium is just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th in Colorado Springs. So check them out at spacesymposium.org. And that brings me to our program today. So I'm very happy to bring back Dr. Kelvin Long. He is an aerospace engineer, physicist, author, and business entrepreneur. He's been working on the problem of interstellar spaceflight since 2007 or so, and he seeks to bring about this hypothetical future as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And he's been involved with the founding of numerous projects, initiatives, and companies which have interstellar spaceflight as a primary goal. He was the originator and co-founder of the Fusion Starship Study Project Icarus, and the co-founder of the Laser Sail Starship Study Project Dragonfly. He's co-founder and executive director for the UK nonprofit, the Initiative for Interstellar Studies. He's a member of the British Interplanetary Society. He has served on its governing council and was assistant editor and chief editor of the Journal for the BIS. He is also a member of the Mars Society, Planetary Society, chartered member of the Institute of Physics. And you can read all about him and his work on the spaceshow.com's website for him and his bio. But time for us to talk about what Kelvin is up to, and we're happy to have him back on the show. So, Kelvin, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Thanks, David. It's really great to be back on.
So why don't we start out, and so tell us what the Initiative for Interstellar Studies, or the Institute for Interstellar Studies in the UK, is all about.
Okay, so it's actually a global organization. The Initiative is actually our UK company, but we actually have a US company as well called the Institute for Interstellar Studies. And we have a new president of that company, which is Robert Kennedy, who is one of the co-founders of the TVIW, which is one of the workshops we all enjoy going to. So we've got two companies in the global arm, and it was founded in September 2012, so we're at the five-year anniversary, and it's really, its mission is to bring about the conditions for interstellar spaceflight, and we don't just mean robots, we mean people, whatever form that may be in the future. We want to send human beings and their progenitors to other star systems, and sort of to bring about the realistic vision of Star Trek, really. And we're really excited about that, and we've been working on that for 5 years. And as you mentioned, I've been working on it longer than that with some of the other organizations. And I'm really happy to report that I'm standing in our new HQ. So we moved in here in June. We've officially opened on the 8th of October. We've got the Apollo 15 astronaut, Al Warden, who's going to come and open the facility for us. So we're very excited about that. And we've got our own library. We've got a cafe space, a high-tech and technology center. We've got a conference room, which in principle can fit 100 people, so we can run conferences here. The building is actually a part of the original Industrial Revolution. So it was built in 1812. And I think that's very appropriate because we're trying to bring about a new revolution in spaceflight. And we're looking forward to really getting our teams in here and thinking about focusing on the problem of interstellar spaceflight. The building is not the only thing we're doing, of course. We're continuing our relationship with the International Space University, Professor Chris Welch. That's been a flourishing relationship for us. We're now, I think, over well over a dozen master's thesis projects that we've helped to manage with the ISU. We won another 3 or 4 this year. We've also run two-week elective courses with them where we've taught the students sort of interstellar studies. We're working with the Breakthrough Initiative in San Francisco, and Pete Warding and Pete Klüper and Yuri Milner and others. So we've got a lot of really exciting things going on, and it's been a great year for us. So we're you know, pretty excited about the future.
Human spaceflight is a lot different than, say, what Breakthrough is working on, which is just to get these tiny little wafers going, maybe 20 or 25% the speed of light. So how do you envision actual human spaceflight on interstellar? Are you talking about human consciousness like AI or something? Or are you talking about taking our actual physical bodies and moving that at interstellar speeds?
Well, my own perspective for the future is actually the distinction between human spaceflight and robotic spaceflight will become increasingly blurred. And we already see human enhancement. I mean, I'm standing here in this HQ holding my smartphone, and there is already enhancing my capabilities to communicate throughout the globe. So I'm already augmented in some way. I actually think that in the future, the idea that we would be talking about robots or humans is actually an anathema. And, you know, I'm talking maybe hundreds of years in the future, but they will actually be merged. And but we're interested in all of those ideas. We're interested in whether it's artificial intelligence, consciousness upload, or human beings actually trying to sit in a world ship and take them to the stars. Of course, the main problem with human spaceflight is the mass, because you need the air, the oxygen, the water, the food, and all of the other sustainability supplies to keep the human population sustained throughout the mission. This creates a very different problem to, say, what Starshot's trying to do, which is to send something which is gram scale in mass to the stars at 10 to 20% of the speed of light. So you're going to get there in decades, which is highly plausible, but of course it still requires large gigawatt power lasers. And the reference study for that at the moment is ground-based, but we're also interested in, from the IFRS's perspective, space-based approaches, and we're pursuing that for our own Project Dragonfly, Project Glowworm, which is our own laser cell project, and how we first got involved with the Breakthrough Initiative. But the main problem is mass, and of course the simple solution to that is essentially bring the cost to LEO down for a start. So that's where you've got people like Blue Origin and SpaceX and reaction engines with the Skyland space plane, SSTO technology, which really starts to bring the cost down to roughly something like $1,000 per kilogram. When you can do that, you create a gateway for space access, and it means you can do more in space. But actually, the idea that we're going to build starships from the regolith of the Earth, I think, is not realistic. I think the starships will be built from space resources, from the asteroids and the moon and other resources. And, of course, that's the way we're heading. So it is a bit further out, of course, than the robotic probes, as we tend to call them. And I won't pretend that they're not. But we still need to continue to work on that problem and think about the possible futures. First of all, it's very exciting to do so. It's what gets us up in the morning and thrills us. But secondly, you never know. I mean, if we suddenly found there was a huge asteroid coming to us, like Shoemaker Levy 9, the comet, which is going to impact the Earth and cause a big problem for our population, and we need to get out there quick. At the very least, all of the federal agencies and NASA and others can turn to a lot of the actually amateur studies that have been done, but to a very professional standard of design vehicles and use that as a starting basis. And what we want to do is to get us as far forward as we can, using the limited resources that we have, and hopefully continue to inspire all of those, also the professional organizations like the federal agencies, to think about deep space exploration, going beyond the Voyager probes, et cetera.
Do you think it is actually, so moving a physical body, like I weigh 200 pounds, for example, that would be augmented somehow, so if and when humans can do interstellar spaceflight, it's not really moving a physical human body like we have today. We're talking about something else, but that has merged with and passes for humans being able to travel interstellar, even though that's probably pretty hard to describe.
Are you talking about space drive?
Yeah, space, moving people into interstellar flight.
So you're referring to pantless systems.
So I'm thinking, is there really a hope for 200 years from now to move a 200-pound body on some kind of a world starship and move them, you know, 50, 100 people at interstellar speeds? Could we be able to do that and support them somehow?
So let me answer that. So I can give you my own perspective. I'm very influenced by Star Trek and Star Wars and all the other wonderful science fiction.
Right.
And the ideas of faster than light travel. And Dr. Sonny White, who's one of my friends who helped me run the New York conference, which we'll talk about a bit later, he does work on warp drive interferometry. And I'm very interested in that subject. But actually, I have reason to think an FTL flight may not be feasible in the future, which is, I would never say impossible, because anyone who says impossible is an idiot. You don't never say impossible. You can go right back to pre-aviation days, and you can see astronomers making big statements about how we can never get to the moon, and miscalculating huge amounts of propellantless fuel, et cetera, et cetera. And also all of the enormous technological innovations that are occurring, which gives you reason to be optimistic about wildcard research. So I would never say never, but I think what's more likely is being able to travel at tens of percent of the speed of light rather than FTL. One of the reasons I worry about going very, very fast is in relativistic speeds, because, of course, Carl Sagan taught us in 1968 that in theory an interstellar ramjet could get to the center of the galaxy in about 28 years, and to the nearest galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, in about 32 years, each can go sort of 99.9999% of speed of light. The problem is you have the time dilation factor. Well, if you imagine you had 100 or 1,000 or 100,000 civilizations in the galaxy, and they're all emerging from their different star systems at different relativistic speeds, at different ages of the galaxy, because all of their stars and the planets have evolved at different rates, it just becomes an intractable problem, in my opinion. It becomes very difficult to try and essentially synchronize our clocks. So I'm not sure that the idea of galactic-wide civilizations in the way that, say, Isaac Asimov has painted in his wonderful foundation theory is plausible. What I wanted to say about human spaceflight, however, which goes back to my earlier comment about robots or humans, if you look at some of the early writing of Arthur Clarke, who was someone that I knew, and he wrote about not only in the future will we be able to fly the airplanes or fly the starships or to drive the submarines, but we will become them. So we will be able to experience all of those things. And, of course, he was talking about full merging of consciousness and AI technology. And I don't think that's unrealistic. I think that's in our probable pathway forward. So at the moment, when we do talk about humans and robots and we have that discussion, I think it's an interesting academic discussion that helps to focus the technological strategies today. But I think in hundreds of years from now, the distinction will become so blurred that it won't be a discussion that we will be having, I don't think, because you will be able to do all kinds of strange things. The big uncertainty in that, of course, is the brain, because we don't understand how the brain works. And there are people that think it's quantum mechanical, such as Roger Penrose. I personally don't. I think it's an emergent phenomenon from evolutionary biology. That's a different discussion. But until we've cracked the brain, we understand the human brain, that would never happen fully. But other than that, all the other parts of the human body are, in theory, reproducible through all kinds of wonderful medical techniques that we have already established. So I do think it's plausible that humans can get to the stars during centuries, but I'm not going to say within decades. But certainly, I do believe that robotic probes can get there. If you look at the Breakthrough Starshot program, which is an inspirational project with $100 million investment, it's got Stephen Hawking, Mark Zuckerberg, and Yuri Milner on the board of directors, and I'm on the advisory committee. And it's doing this incredible project, which I see as a form of moonshot, to try and send something this grand scale to the stars using 50 sort of gigawatt power beam. Now, you might say, well, what's the point? Because you're just going to take a photograph. But by then, any telescopes that we have in orbit, the very advanced sort of Kepler's and Hubble space telescopes in the future, will pretty much be able to image all those things anyway. So how can you justify that expenditure? Well, my justification is that the existence of that R&D program, which is essentially what it is going to enable us to make all kinds of breakthroughs and discoveries in technology and science, which is going to open up new possibilities. So I actually think that the Breakthrough Starship program is one of the most exciting things ever to happen in the interstellar community. And I urge everyone out there to really get behind it and to try to help make it happen.
Absolutely. We've done quite a few shows on Starshot, and it is very inspiring, and I think it needs to be out there a lot more. More people need to find out about it. I have a question from you from Ted in San Diego, California, via email, and he says, do recent movies that focus on interstellar flight to one degree or another hurt or help the cause?
Oh, I definitely think they help. I don't know how much they make, but it's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office. So I saw Passengers. I thought it was an excellent film with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. And actually, in this space where I'm standing right now, this headquarters, we have several Starship models, and one of those is the Avalon, which is the Starship from Passengers. So obviously that's influenced us. And we've had this debate about how it works, because there's these claims out there that it's a fusion engine. Yes. I don't think that's right. I think it actually would be some sort of ion engine using a fusion reactor. And the thing at the front of it is possibly ionizing the plasma, the interstellar medium. But of course it goes at 50% of the speed of light. Even with a fusion engine, you could not go at 50% of the speed of light. The laws of physics do not allow that amount of energy to come out of a fusion reaction. So there are physics issues. And it's the same with Interstellar, which, again, was a great, great film. And Kip Thorne was involved with that. The same as he was with Contact, which is based on the novel by Carl Sagan. But this, of course, uses wormholes, which is cheating. Wormholes are very exciting. I studied general relativity. And Kip Thorne, of course, is one of the world experts on the subject. But it cheats. It cheats the ideas. I would like to see a real hard science fiction film that places the physics accuracy at the heart of the film. And there is an example of that, which is 2001 Space Odyssey, after Clark and Stanley Kubrick, which is an amazing film. But of course, it does go past that into the fantasy, because you have the Star Child, you have the traveling through some sort of Stargate across the universe, which, again, is not within known physics. It's conjecture, as we would call it. But it's interesting. So maybe those sorts of shows, although the physics may not always be proven, it does help to inspire people to want to reach for it. I know that Miguel Tibia recently presented at the Icarus Starship Congress, which was a tremendous achievement for that team. And he wrote his paper in 1994 on warp drive. And actually, that's where I started. I did general relativity at university, and I started looking at warp drive, and I looked at his paper. And so then I got into more practical interstellar methods like fusion, and now I'm dealing with laser beams. So ideas like that, even though they are conjecture, but they're grounded in rigorous science at the bottom line, and they do help to bring people in. So yes, the answer to your question is movies really do help, and I'd like to see more of them. I'm really looking forward to the next Avatar film, in fact.
In Passengers, when they took a little romantic stroll as a spacewalk at interstellar speeds, is that a plausible thing to do, or was that a little taking liberties with the science fiction?
Well, if they were going at 50% of the speed of light, they're in the inertial frame of the spacecraft, so there's no reason they couldn't go out of the spacecraft in principle. The thing I would worry about is the interstellar medium. You've got dust impacts, which might be 5 nanograms in size in the ISM, which is quite large, which has a lot of kinetic energy. We're talking about something like a Nagasaki-type detonation, potentially, if that hits you. And you've also got charged particles, so mostly hydrogen, but also helium and other things. And so their survivability is at risk. So I think if they had come out being protected by a particle shield in front of them, it might have been a little bit plausible. But no science fiction is great if it doesn't have a riveting story. And that was a riveting story, so it was worth including.
Speaking of the dust impact, so realistically, with Starshot, for example, what's the vulnerability of these wafers at 20-25% the speed of light and hitting dust?
So I've actually looked at this, but that's one of the physics problems I've been working on, and I presented at our conference in New York in June, it is a problem, and I've estimated for something like you're looking at about 2.57 × 10⁻²⁴ kilograms per meter cubed, I think it is. It might be per centimeter cubed, I can't remember the actual unit, but that's roughly the matter density of the ISM, and that's provided the world expert. This is Bruce Drain, who's a professor at Princeton University. And he gave me that number himself. And I've calculated the problem actually for Starshot. And I estimated for something like a 5 nanogram-ish dust impact, you might be looking at maybe 10 per hour flight, sorry, if you're talking about a 20-year flight. So there's not a large number of impacts, but of course each one of those is quite deadly. And it's the same with the charged particles. There's a lot of charged particles, which all have a, what's called a stopping power. They get so far and then they stop in the material. So the answer to this, I think, is statistics. So you send maybe hundreds of thousands of these things, and there's a certain statistical probability that some of them are going to get through. And given that they're so easy to produce, you know, I mean, the big cost probably is the firing of the laser, because it's a 50-gigawatt power beam, and you've got to keep firing that. But if you can, you know, get it down to maybe firing one per day or something like that, and you could send thousands of these things out there, there's a statistical probability that some will get through. And but it is an issue, and we can't ignore that. When Yuri Milner went live with Project Starshot in April of last year, he announced about 19 physics problems which we need to think about, and engineering problems as well, from communications to dust and charged particle impacts, to navigation and telemetry, all kinds of problems that we need to look at. And really, he was setting out a grand challenge to the community to start working on these problems. But, you know, when Robert Kennedy, and I'm looking at a picture of him right now in this room, when he gave his famous 1960s Rice University speech, saying we're going to go to the moon and do the other things, not because they're easy, but because they're hard, using technology not yet invented. It's the same with Starshot. Starshot is using technology that's not yet invented. We have a basic plans for it. We think it's scalable. We think the lasers are scalable, whether it's microwave beams or laser beams. And we think the cost will come down sufficiently to enable the program to be affordable. And we think that the microelectronics will continue to scale along the sort of Moore's Law level, such that within 15, 20 years maybe, that we can launch this mission and it becomes plausible. The thing I would think about, of course, is if there's ET on those other star systems and they see all these little probes coming towards us, they might think, what is this? Which I think would be really interesting. And of course, if we could get them down to something like a gram in mass, and maybe even the size of a postage stamp or even a grain of sand, then that presents all kinds of interesting possibilities, such as how do we know there isn't such things flying through our solar system from other civilizations out there today? Of course, this was a part of the theme of the famous Larry Niven and Gerald Cornell novel, The Moti in God's Eye, where they see this red dot in the distance. It turns out to be the end of a laser beam pushing the solar cell.
George is in Denver, Colorado, with an email, and he said lots of people, including Elon Musk and now Putin, are raising the flag about AI and robotics and how it might advance and hurt people. Do you see that as a risk as more and more work is being done to develop these fields for interstellar flight?
I think that there is a tendency to for everyone to sort of fear about the future and to paint this idea of these singularities. That seems to be a sort of hobby of a lot of technologists at the moment, is to think about different types of singularities that exist in the future. And I go back to Arthur Clarke, who he actually believed that humankind was actually a stepping stone to something greater than us, which he called full-blown artificial intelligence. And it was along the lines of merging with humanity, with human beings in some form. So Homo sapiens will become the AI will become us. And he talked about that in books such as Profiles of the Future in the 1960s and some of his later books. And you can see some of those themes in some of his science fiction novels. Now, there's two ways to approach that. The first is to we could fear it, and we could say, well, that could potentially indicate the end of humanity, even if it's thousands of years down the line. Or it could be an opportunity for the embracement of a new evolution for humankind. I mean, one of the things that excites me about our journey today with science is that we have been subject to the Darwinian laws of evolution for millions of years. That is how we have evolved. That's what the evidence points to on this planet. And so we are, for the first time in our history, at a position where we are essentially diverging from Darwinian evolution, or at least we have the potential to, because we can accelerate things much faster. The question is, where does that take us to? And that's a more philosophical question. And it also comes down to what does it mean to be human? Do we envisage human beings to be a bipedal creature with two legs, two arms, two eyes, two ears, etc.? Or is human about what our character is, what our moral character is, and how we face the universe? You know, with as Carl Sagan said, less of our weaknesses and more of our strength. I mean, we know that if we spend too much time in space, that in microgravity, that certain things happen, such as the loss of bone, the bone density due to the calcium loss in human bodies. And we know that you know, there's been speculations that if you had a human being in a very low gravity space station for a long time and they carried on producing children, what's the purpose of those legs? Essentially, they would maybe evolve to a second set of arms. These are speculative ideas about how we might evolve. Given that, it does raise the question, what does it mean to be human? And I think being human is not necessarily about how we look. Being human is about what our moral character is and how we choose to face the universe and the sort of decisions we make. And so that changes the dynamic of the question, I think.
That's hard to get your hands around, isn't it, to wrap around that humans may have nothing to do with how we look.
I think so. And if you look at actually, you know, the diversity of life on the planet, I mean, there's just, I forget how many, I used to know the number, but there's something like 90,000 different types of insect species or something like that. I mean, we discover new species every year we never knew existed. That tells you something. It tells you that nature can design differently. And we also know about the idea that you can have nature discovering different systems several times, different ideas like wings in several different types of creatures. So nature is very smart in the way it designs things, and it seems to adapt. And it enables organisms to adapt to the environment. I think what we need to embrace the more... we have the things such as the... we worry about spacecraft contaminating planets. And we worry about bringing bacteria back from Mars because it could contaminate the Earth and so forth. I think that... I understand the direction of those concerns. But actually, you know, we're 90% non-human anyway. There are trillions of microorganisms inside the human body which are not human. We are already largely non-human. And I don't think people appreciate that. If you dig into the structure of a human being, it's 90% non-human because of all these microorganisms which come from the rest of the plant and animal kingdom. And so, you know, I think nature will adapt human beings. And I think what's needed is a more kind of ecological perspective to space exploration in how we think about how organisms survive in different environments, rather than saying we're going to have a human being and we're going to build a spacecraft around it and we're going to tailor the spacecraft and the atmosphere and all the structures sort of optimized for that human being. Actually, I think it should be sort of inverted. I think you need to think about what's the optimum solution to enable the mission to happen, preserving certain fundamentals such as what we decide is human, and then making the adaptabilities as necessary. And I appreciate that brings lots of ethical concerns because lots of people may not like that. But I think if we are really honest about embracing interstellar spaceflight, it is one of the challenges that awaits us. It's that big question, are you prepared for the changes you need to make in your civilization and in your human construct, what you consider to be human, to enable those missions to occur? Because I think that those changes are profound. And the idea that we're just going to throw a load of human beings into a world ship and send them off to the stars is wonderful and romantic and based on ideas like Gerald O'Neill's Anal Cylinders, which are an excellent study. But I think the future will be painted very differently.
Carol is in Seattle, and she says, I think all of this is really interesting, but right now we're struggling to return human spaceflight to something like the International Space Station and maybe the moon. And you're talking about interstellar flight and things that are so far off into the future. So I'm wondering if there is a lot that you can study that actually leads to contributing to interstellar flight, given how primitive we are in that we can't even get humans back up to the space station very easily yet, let alone going anywhere further than Leo. What do you think about that?
I think that's a really important question. I'm going to address it in two parts. First of all, I want to make the claim that we tend to think it's the governments which get us into space, which get us to the moons of Mars and beyond. That has been traditionally the way things have worked. We can see this crossover that's happening now towards the commercialization of space, which I think is a necessary thing to occur. But actually, the moon program didn't start with NASA. The moon program didn't start with NASA. Actually, neither did the ISS. If you go back to the history of all these projects, including the space shuttle, you can find their origins. If you can go back to the 1920s or 30s, organizations like the British Interplanetary Society in London and Liverpool and their moonship studies, how we get to the moon, the work done by the VFR in Germany, thinking about the V2, how we get into space and so forth. Of course, it was the V2 that first broke the 50-mile barrier. And Robert Goddard with his rocket. A lot of these guys were amateurs. They weren't professionals. They weren't sponsored by the government. Okay, so Robert Goddard, I think, had lots of money from, I think it was Arizona State University eventually. But a lot of these guys were amateurs, and they were saying, we can do it in the future. We can go into space. We can go to the moon. When Arthur Clarke wrote his famous 1940s wireless wallpaper on satellites in orbit, he was an amateur. He was essentially a science fiction author that was just coming out of the Second World War. He'd written a few books and science fiction stories. And yet, look what all happened with the satellites. So, in other words, if we continue to paint the picture of what the future is, and we continue to work on those problems that others aren't working, it brings about the possibility so that when someone like President Kennedy says to his team, okay, guys, we're in this competitive battle with Russia, and we're worried about the implications to the culture of the West and the East and who's the best, et cetera, et cetera, can we do it? What can we actually do in space? And they sit down, they look at the books that are published, they look at the papers that are published, the reports, and they say, well, we think it's plausible because these studies have been done, and they suggest if you do it this way, it might be possible. And then they can sort of estimate it, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing I would say, is that it doesn't start with the federal agencies. It doesn't start with them. It starts with a dream, with a vision. And essentially, that's what we're doing. We're working on a vision so that hopefully those with the money can pick it up. And that's exactly what's happened. Yuri Milner, as I said, has announced $100 million investment into a laser-scale, gram-scale project to the nearest stars. So that is commercial industry, at least, taking our ideas from people like Robert Forward and advancing them to the next level. Now, going to the next part of the question, which I want to address, which is, I think you have to understand what happened with history. There was this debate with in America. They were concerned about Sputnik 1 in 1957. And America decided that they had to catch up with the Russians because they got the dog in space, Laika, they got the first man in space, the first woman in space. They did a lot of amazing things. And so eventually the Americans caught up and they went on and won the moon, as it were. But of course, there was a lot of politics going on at the time in America. You had the Vietnam War that was occurring. At its peak, the Project Apollo program was about 4.6% of the gross national product of the United States. It wasn't that high. Today, it's something like less than 0.5% of the federal budget. It's small. The amount of money that's spent on space isn't huge. The two big projects, which have taken up a lot of the money post Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, is really the ISS and the space shuttle program, both of which have been highly successful. The ISS is probably the first great wonder of space ever to be constructed by humankind. And it is a truly human endeavor. It started as the Freedom Space Station, as you know, and then it became the ISS with Japan, Russia, Europe, all of the great countries involved in constructing it. And, I wish we could find a way to push its orbit and keep it up there. And I would like to see what's the next generation space station. And, of course, the space shuttle was a necessary stepping stone to constructing that space station, and both of those programs have taught us a lot about how to do big budget space programs, other than just one-shot kind of moonshot missions, and how to have human beings living in space. We've learned a lot about medical science, about materials technology, and we're at that really exciting period now where commercial industry can take all that stuff. Elon Musk can take the idea of a rocket, which has been launched many, many times, and say, well, can we improve on it? Can we make it reusable? Let's try and manufacture 95% of components in-house. Let's try and fly back the first stage and he's achieving it. So these are really exciting things that are happening. But to me, the thing that always gets in the way is the politics. So that's why I'm excited about some of the commercialization, because it has the potential to at least mitigate some of that politics, if not remove it entirely in some cases. We're always subject to the world politics, but it's so I'm excited about what's going to happen in the next tens of years. But what I would love to see happening personally is, I was born in 1974, and of course in 1972, 1973, you had the Pioneer probes. In 1977, a couple of years after I was born, we had the Voyager 1 and 2 probes. We're at the 40th anniversary of Voyager this year, this month and last month, in fact. What's the next space probe? Okay, so we've got the New Horizons probe out there, which is around Pluto. And by the way, I want to give a shout-out to the One Earth Message, which is a project by John Lomberg, who works with Carl Sagan on the Voyager Golden Record. And they've got a Kickstarter campaign going on at the moment, so please visit Kickstarter and visit their website. And they're trying to get a project to beam photographs and information to the New Horizons spacecraft. So if you can support that, that will really help to generate interest from the public. But I want to know what's the next level. There have been ideas like the 1,000 Astronomical Unit mission, which JPL was really behind, and that was cancelled, unfortunately. I would like to see, you know, embracement of nuclear technologies, which would get us to Mars and beyond, and nuclear thermal rockets. I'd like to see electric ion engines be used to take us right out to the outer planets and back, potentially, maybe human missions. You know, we forget that Ted Taylor and Freeman Dyson worked on Project Orion in the 1960s with General Atomics and the U.S. Air Force and others. And that was about a 10-year program, spent about $7 billion. And that was the idea of taking people to Saturn and back. Freeman Dyson was actually telling his children, we're going to Saturn and back, guys, get ready. And his children grew up thinking they were going to Saturn. And, of course, that was cancelled. That was never going to happen. But what's the next level? So let's say we get to the moon, go back to the moon, we're able to mine the asteroids. All those things are necessary stepping stones. But what's the next big mission? And that's what I would like to see the agencies working on personally.
This is a good point. We're halfway through, and we're going to take our pause, Kelvin. So, listeners, we're going to stop for a couple of minutes, and we will be right back and with more of our show. Our phone line is available for those of you that can access it and you're not listening at work. It is 1-866-687-7223, and remember, we do answer the phone during the break. Email for more of your email questions, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll be back 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody, part two of the Space Show program. I do want to thank our sponsors for the second segment of the program. So we do have Orbital ATK, and they're known as the global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is also a sponsor. I hope I make it down for Space 2017 in Orlando. They're going to have another notice posted on their website about Hurricane Irma, for those of you interested in going. That'll be late Thursday afternoon. Anyway, AIAA has 30,000 individual members, and they represent 88 or 90 countries, close to 100 corporate members, and they're busy shaping and sharing the future of aerospace every day. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. And then Celestis is our sponsor. And remember, they are the global leader, probably the only people doing Memorial spaceflight services. And they have a DNA service that they are doing. Plus, they also have a flight coming up called Earthrise Mission. And this is where they send a symbolic portion of one's cremated remains or DNA. This could be your DNA. You don't have to have passed away for this. And goes into space and returns in a capsule to Earth, creating a flown keepsake. And seven Earthrise missions have been flown so far out of Las Cruces, New Mexico. Mission number 8, the Star Seeker flight, is going to go on November 15th. Family members experience up close a tour of the Up Aerospace Mission Control Center and an on-the-pad viewing of the Spaceloft XL rocket, which is part of their 3-day memorial celebration for the event. And they have flights at 6 locations worldwide for Celestis. If you want more information, check them out at celestis.com. And Kelvin, you had a June meeting in New York that was part of your interstellar organization. Why don't you tell us about that? It was the Foundations of Interstellar Studies workshop on interstellar flight.
Yeah, so that was the U.S. company. Robert Kennedy and myself really ran that. And we had the two key chairmen behind it was myself and Professor Roman Cesares-Valli from the Theoretical Physics Department at CityTech in Brooklyn. Greg Matlock was involved, and Dr. Harold Sonny White from NASA Johnson Space Center. And basically, I've been to a lot of interstellar conferences, and they've all been wonderful. I mean, there's nothing like networking, getting together with old friends. But one of my concerns is that there's a lot of top-level presentations, a lot of overviews. And I actually think we need more focus. We do need those conferences. We do need the overviews. But I think we need more focus as well. So what I tried to do was I tried to create a conference or a workshop that was a very small gathering, about 50 people, and I deliberately capped the numbers. And the reason is because I studied some of the famous physics workshops, such as the Shetland Islands Conference, the Foundation of Quantum Mechanics in 1947, and also the Physics Norway Conference, Physics and Chemistry in Brussels in 1911. I actually stayed at the Hotel Metropole only last year in Brussels, where the original conference was held with Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein and others. Niels Bohr wasn't at the Solar Conference, he was at the Shetland Islands one, but Albert Einstein was, and Marie Curie. And I wanted to create a workshop which really was focused on fundamental problems in interstellar flight. So it didn't quite go quite according to what the vision was, because I realized there's some practicalities which make it a bit more difficult. But what we did produce is a super set of very high technical level presentations. So the idea was to keep the gathering small, no external tours, get everyone in a room together, maximize social reactions, increase speaker time, lots of workshop discussion. So, for example, we just have an hour where we just discuss, like Robert Freeland did a paper on one of his fusion engine designs, which just discussed the physics of the fusion engine and what the problems were. We had speakers such as Ryan Weed from Positron Dynamics in San Francisco talking about his anti-electron physics ideas for spaceflight. Stanley Cohen taught from the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory. We had Lockheed Martin Skunk Works with Gina Sullivan talking about their new fusion engine design that they're trying to basically solve the problem of fusion on Earth. Michelle Lemonsky was talking about heat transfer systems. Robert Freeland, I mentioned, plasma dynamics and Z-pinch fusion systems. We had so many top-level, really excellent presentations. Ralph McNutt was there talking about human exploration with the solar system. I always enjoy Ralph Tuck's talks. Lou Friedman talking about the solar gravitational lens. It really was a great collection of speakers, and everyone enjoyed it. The actual start of the event was at the Harvard Club of New York, and that was a wonderful event. And we had a lot of artists there who were displaying some of their art. This included Adrian Mann, David Hardy, Alex Stura, Kerry Weatherby, Alexandra Limpert, Carmela Tilbaron, Rick Sternbach, C-Bangs. And we had all these artists come together with their art and try to interact with the scientists, because I'm very keen on the interaction of the sciences and the arts, because one of my greatest heroes is Leonardo da Vinci. And, of course, he was talking about vehicles that only came into fruition centuries later. And he embraced both the art and the sciences, although then it wasn't called the sciences, but he was interested in science and engineering. And I think that actually when you bring disciplines together, that's where the beautiful stuff happens. So that's what we kind of try to do. A lot of the artists also attended the technical workshop, which I'm sure was very enjoyable for them. And what we're now doing is we've received about 30 papers from the presenters, and they're all going to the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, for which I used to be the chief editor. And they're going to be submitted as the proceeding. And the feedback I had was that a lot of the speakers really appreciated having extra time rather than being rushed, and also having time to be scrutinized. And I also didn't allow any media in the room, because it's not that I don't like the media. It's because scientists will tend to give a particular pitch if they think that their conversations are being recorded or going to be in a magazine. So I wanted scientists to be able to scrutinize each other in a free, open environment. And so we had really, really good discussions. And I actually jokingly tried to get some fights going. Fights is probably a bit of a strong word, but I did have a really interesting moment with Greg Matloff and Lou Friedman and a few other people. But unfortunately, they're two nice people, so I didn't succeed. But they had some really good arguments and about the physics of world ships and solar cells and whether solar cells can withstand the particle bombardment of dust and so forth. So it was a really good meeting. And so, as I say, our origins is really some of the original sort of physics and quantum mechanics meetings in the early part of last century. That's what we try to replicate. And we're going to have another one probably in 2018. And it's either going to be here at our HQ, or we might consider even going to Brussels, to the Hotel Metropole, which is where I was staying last year when I visited the BIS symposium. So it's an exciting meeting, and everyone will see the proceedings coming out in the coming months, hopefully.
So the proceedings will be available through the BIS, right?
That's correct, yes. It'll all be published papers.
How do we find out about it? Is there a website that will tell us that the proceedings are available?
Yes, if you go on to the I4S website, www.i4s.org, you'll find some information about the New York workshop on the blog page, Starship Blog, and you'll find a link from one of those to the webpage at CityTech, where we were managing the conference. So CityTech did all the administration for the conference, and Elena Ancona in particular, who's was a fantastic secretary for the entire conference. She did such a wonderful job. And so you can find more information there. We've actually put a lot of presentations already online, and we're in the process of putting a few more on. And the papers are going through submission peer review at the moment, and obviously that's an academic process. And also, if you see the Principium magazine, which I4S produces, and we're on our 18th issue, which is published, edited by John Davis, and it's a wonderful community magazine all about interstellar. And we've just published a little bit of an article on the New York workshop, and we've got a few articles coming out talking about some of the technical stuff, which I apparently have got to write, so I'm looking forward to writing this.
Okay, sounds really interesting, and we'll look for these papers, and I'll call them to the attention of listeners, because this is a topic that we're also very interested in on the Space Show. We don't seem to be able to get enough of breakthrough propulsion and interstellar activity.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very popular topic right now. And I think people would like to see a lot more work done on it. And it is fascinating, to say the least. I actually think it's more fascinating than more conventional LEO chemical rocket spaceflight, which I want to see happen too. But
well, I probably agree with you. Obviously, I'm interested in interstellar, but it's not to say all the other stuff isn't important. Obviously, you acknowledge that because you have all those speakers on the show as well. Right. It's all important. It's all about pushing humanity out there, making us, as Elon Musk often says, a multi-planetary species. So it's all geared towards that driver. But my particular angle is that I am keen on producing a stretch mission, the idea that we're just going to jump in and try and do something really visionary and see if we can make it happen. And even if it isn't achieved in my lifetime, I'm sure that all of us working on this problem would have contributed towards making it happen at some point. So it may be incremental, but I'm trying to push it, accelerate it even faster than that the pace is going with currently. But in my time in Interstellar since 2007, it's been 10 years, and I've been a part of several organizations, many projects, published many papers and articles, many radio interviews and documentaries, and it's been a lot of fun, a lot of hard work as well. But I've definitely seen a sea change, and you know, I want to really put the credit out there to the organizations that have created that, which is obviously the Institute for Interstellar Studies. This is one of the five of the organizations. Icarus Interstellar, which I was originally a part of, founded in 2011, based on the original project Icarus in 2009. Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop, which I think was founded in 2013, but I'm not sure. The Tau Zero Foundation, which was set up by Mark Millis, former NASA Glenn guy. He's been working on this problem longer than a lot of us, you know, the original Interstellar Propulsion Society at NASA Glenn and others. And they've got a new CEO, Rhonda Stevenson, who's doing a fantastic job moving that organization forward. So all of those organizations, and of course the British Interplanetary Society, which has been here since 1933, have been pushing this interstellar vision forward, and it's making a difference. And we've got to believe that it is.
Joe sent you an email out of New York, and he says, Dr. Long, is there anything related to interstellar flight that could be done on a very short time scale as an experiment or some sort of technology demonstrator, even if it fails?
Does he mean actually getting to the stars, or does he mean precursor mission?
I don't know what he means. That's his email. So I think what he's after is is there any kind of experiment related to interstellar flight? And I guess he's sort of thinking of faster than light travel, or at least approaching the speed of light travel, that could be done as a demonstrator or something on a very short term, even if it failed.
Yeah, so I would like to see research done for obviously space missions that go you know, past the Voyagers. That's entirely achievable. Voyagers launched in 1977. They're still transmitting. They run out in about 2025 due to plutonium power source. But I'd like to see missions that go beyond that, out into the Oort cloud, which is sort of 2,500 to 50,000 AU. And that's something that we can do today using electric ion engines. You know, I visited, I think it was NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, where they had an ion engine running for several years concurrently in a vacuum chamber, very advanced ion engine. I forget the name of it. You know, there are things we can do in space which can move the technology forward, and obviously Starshot, where I've mentioned several times, which in the future maybe Starshot would look at doing some sort of demonstration mission before we try and do the full-up mission to get stuff out there. I mean, Mason Peck talked about sending these little chips out, for example, into the magnetosphere of Jupiter, and they have charge, so they go around the orbit of Jupiter. And then what happens is you flip switch the charge off. And, of course, due to Lorentz force, they just fly straight out and potentially thousands of kilometers per second into deep space. So lots of ideas out there. Now, my particular interest, because I don't have access to the big rockets and the big satellites, although my team is working on CubeSat missions, we have Project Dragonfly, which is our overarching laser cell program, and we have a project called Project Glowworm, which Andreas Hein is running, the chairman of my technical committee, and he is looking at putting a CubeSat into orbit within maybe 3 to 5 years, that will start to do laser cell missions in space. So that's a demonstrator, so we're working on that. And we've got a huge number of our team which are helping with that. My particular interest is actually in ground-based experiments, what we can do. So as a physicist, I used to work on both numerical modeling but also experiments. And I'm interested in what we can do on the ground that helps to validate some of the technologies and the models that we want to see in space at some point in the future. I already mentioned Sonny White. He's doing the warp drive interferometry measurements at the Eagle Works Lab at NASA Johnson Space Center, and I visited there last year. Did fantastic work. And, you know, there's other things we could do, for example, to experiment whether the ideas of there being extra dimensions of space, whether the quantum vacuum exists in the way we think it does, or whether wormholes could exist at a quantum level. You know, the way that John Wheeler used to talk about where you could potentially expand one. We might be able to do some of those in the future. The particle accelerator just help with a lot of that knowledge because they're going very, very fast. But in this building, so we've got this big conference room which can fit some 100 people in, which is for our workshops and our lectures and so forth. And we've got these meeting rooms. But actually below me, there's a huge basement. And we've got a massive workshop. And we've also got a laboratory. And we're planning to do some really interesting experiments over the next few years in our laboratory, which moves things forward. So we're going to create essentially a playroom for our teams. Anyone else who wants to come here to just experiment with building stuff and see what happens. And we think that's really exciting. So it's a bit like a sort of makerspace lab, and just getting people rolling their sleeves up, trying to build stuff and see if they can actually get things working, play around with comm signals or laser beams. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is some of the ideas, for example, of Professor Rachel Armstrong of Newcastle University, who talks about, in a recent Star Art book, the ideas of creating sustainable world ships and ecological approaches to space exploration. I'm keen on exploring some of those. And actually, we think about a world ship as being this sort of 200-kilometer long, 20-kilometer wide cylinder, something like Rama from Arthur Clarke's novel. There's things we can do on Earth to actually start to investigate those technologies today, whether it's the atmospheres or how the organisms interact, what the environmental conditions are. So we can start to explore those things today. And that's what my particular interest is. Although I'm mainly a propulsion guy, I'm really interested in exploring some of those sort of ecological ideas of actually how those different things, organisms interact with each other in different biospheres, for example. So that's the sort of things we're planning to do.
You have another email from Beverly in Tucson, and Beverly says, in terms of new physics graduates or people studying physics at the higher level in colleges and universities, does the fact that Interstellar indicates really a long time out in the future hinder getting top people into the field, or is it a real attractive field for people to want to go into?
So when I first got involved in this field, there were very few people, for example, doing the warp drive stuff. I did a symposium at the BIS in 2007, and there were about 65 papers at the time ever published that even referred to warp drive metrics. Now there's thousands, and it's the same with wormholes and other exotic. It's become credible and allowable for academics, particularly graduate students or interns or to actually do some of this research, and there are four fully-fledged professors even looking at it. Because I think, you know, our perspectives have changed. We know we've discovered hundreds and hundreds of exoplanets, so we know there's worlds out there. It's not just conjecture now. And therefore, it's a question of the technologies we would use to get there, so it's become more permissible to explore those sorts of things. Actually, one of my issues is not enough universities are working on the problem. I would like to see, you know, a dream for me would be a full master's program dedicated to interstellar studies. And one of the things we do here with my deputy director, Robert Swinney, is we run a course called Starship Engineering. We've run it at the BIS in London a few times. And what we do is we get a bunch of people together for a day, maybe, or two, and we throw them into a problem, like the Voyager probes. We teach them all about how the different systems work and subsystems. And then we ask for a change requirement on the vehicle. And then they have to redesign the vehicle, and they've got a couple of hours to do it, and then they've got to present it. And that's the sort of education course that we run, and we're running it again in November, 25th, 26th of November at our HQ in Gloucestershire. See our website if you want to, or Twitter account or Facebook if you want to get involved. And we're also running a course, a Starship Engineering course, next year in the US. I won't say any more about that at the moment, but that's going to be really exciting for us. And we also work with the International Space University, which I mentioned. And now we're working with the City Tech in New York and a few other universities we've worked with, like University of Southampton. I would like to see more universities get involved. What essentially I'm doing here is, we've got the team, is creating a home for our people, for our community, all over the world. So anybody that's interested in Interstellar, whether it's a media person who likes to write articles for a magazine, whether it's an artist who wants to do drawings, renditions, you know, engineering layout, paintings, whether it's a physicist who wants to work on solving problems, someone that just advocates for the problem, this is their home. Anyone who's working at Interstellar is welcome at our HQ to come and visit us. And what we actually want to do in the future, as well as having conferences, workshops, lectures, meetings. You know, we can have all our business meetings here. Is we want to create an opportunity for interns and graduate students to even come and stay here for several months at a time. And say if you want to work on a problem like the interstellar ramjet or asteroid mining, mining the helium-3 from the moon or something like that, that's relevant to the pathway to interstellar flight, then we, in the future, would like to have a situation where people can come stay here in our facility for several months and they can do the research. PhD students, but anybody that wants to do the research, we're interested in attracting them to our building and in our HQ. And that's kind of one of the primary functions. Let me just say a little bit about that. If you look at all of the interstellar organizations, I mentioned some of them already, who are all doing fantastic work to move the vision forward. There's a couple of things that we don't have in the community. One is cohesion as a group, as a collective. The second is resources, financial resources. The Tau Zero Foundation were just given $500,000, a grant to do some, I think from NASA, to do some propulsion studies, which is amazing and brilliant. But we don't have a lot of resources in general. And, you know, we kind of need to pull together as a community. So what we're interested in doing is creating a focus, because that's the other thing that's lacking, is everyone does make these conferences and they have these meetings and publish their papers. But what's the focus? Where's it going? So you're helping to advocate for the vision. You're helping to promote the work that's being done. And in some cases, mostly minor, you're solving some of the actual technical problems. But what's the focus? So part of the reason for this HQ is to help focus the community on the vision of the stars. So I want to get everyone from any interstellar organization to come here and start to work together and to come up with a cohesive strategy, something like the Integrated Space Plan, which we have on our wall, which you mentioned during the break. And, you know, we'd like to produce our own version of that, which is has a critical pathway for getting to the stars as quickly as possible, whether it's the robots or the humans or something in between. And let's start to focus on those problems. And I think until that happens, until we start focusing, we're just going to keep drifting and moving forward incrementally. And although incrementally is important, and it's good that we're still moving forward at least, for me that's not good enough. We need to go faster.
You have a caller on hold. Let's see if they're still with us. Good morning, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Good to hear from you.
My ears really picked up when you mentioned the workshop in your basement, and you were just talking about the limitations you have due to resources. And I wanted to ask what you have for your workshop right now, and especially what you would really like to have in that workshop, the kinds of equipment that you would need, and if any of that has any focus on modeling, on supercomputer kind of modeling, or is it all hardware?
Hi, Kim. Nice to hear your voice. Nice to speak to you. So at the moment, we have this great big empty basement with a lot of boxes around the side of it, and they're full of about $10,000 worth of tooling, which is mostly what you might call hard tools, ones you're going to get dirty with. We would like to have some electronics. We would like to do a lot of Arduino stuff because we believe that's relevant to the future. Raspberry Pis. We have a guy in our team, Richard Osborne, who's an expert on this and is doing some building. For example, we're going to have some data sensors on the roof, whether it's meteorology or looking at meteors or astronomy, and we're going to feed that direct to our LED screens down in the main conference room. So you can come in, you can actually see the latest data. We've already got some telescopes. We'd like to have a radio telescope at some point. And so we can kind of play with thinking about doing astronomy or whatever it is we're interested in. But we'd kind of like to have a makerspace lab where we can just play around with building stuff. So if you look at our Twitter account, for example, just for fun, because I've got two little daughters and they like to see me doing silly things, I built a world ship in 4 days about 2 weeks ago, and you can see it on the I4S Twitter account. And it looks a bit what's called Heath Robinson, lots of bits of sticky tape together and so forth. But I thought it would be fun just to see what I could do in a few days. I didn't have the capacity to do more than 4 days. But I built this kind of model of a world ship about 1.5 meters long. So it would be really cool to get people. We got Terry Reagan in our team. He built the Daedalus model for the BIS. He's currently building us our Event Horizon spacecraft model and our Discovery 1 model, which we're going to be hosted in this facility. And I would like to get people like him and others coming together to build some really sophisticated models. Now, there's a big difference, of course, between a model and something that's actually flight-worthy. There's an enormous difference, and in between there are various forms of prototypes moving up the TRL level. So what I would like to do is to try and approach that. You start with the models, maybe, and then you go with a more sophisticated model that actually does some of the subsystems that you'd actually have in a real spacecraft, whether it's the navigation or the environmental controls, to start to play around. And we mentioned CubeSats, we mentioned Arduinos, and we've got some guys in our team who are looking at some of that stuff. So that's the sort of things we want to have. We only got this building on the 23rd of June, and our main focus has been on the upstairs, but we have this huge basement downstairs and this laboratory, which we need to kit up the laboratory more. So we need oscilloscopes. We need pressure vessels for vacuum chamber testing. I've been talking to, for example, companies in Vienna. I've flown to Vienna a couple of times, talked to a company out there about doing experiments for us on laser cell propulsion. I'd like to actually do some of those ourselves. But actually the science involved in that, the calibration issues and the uncertainties on the measurements is very, very difficult unless you know what you're doing. But fortunately, our team is mostly scientists. So that's the sort of things we want to do. But what we want to do is to create a kind of game change in what's possible. We want this to be a tree that is nurtured. And we show, you know, if with our limited resources, if we can do this, what could we do if we had 1,000 times the budget of this? And hopefully inspire some people to do something better or even sponsor us. And yes, we need sponsorship. We do have some sponsorship, and that's what's enabled us to move forward and get our HQ. But we do need more if we're going to actually do more both on the ground and in space.
Interesting. But certainly Britain has a very fine tradition of doing exactly this kind of thing, the long history of the British Planetary Society.
Sorry to interrupt you, Kim. You mentioned numerical models. I should say I'm a Fortran programmer. I love my programming friends tell me that's not a real programming language, but I love Fortran. And I've written quite a few programs that do, you know, fusion propulsion, laser sails, et cetera, et cetera. And I would like to have some sort of numerical facility up and running, even if it means we're using somebody else's supercomputer. I've used the biggest supercomputer in the UK and in Europe. And I've also used some of the ones in the US. It would be great to get access to some of that sort of stuff, maybe at some point to develop our own codes, produce integrated codes for interstellar spaceflight. That's the sort of thing we would like to do, but that requires people, it requires man hours, it requires money. So in the future, I hope that we can do that.
Yeah, that certainly seems like an avenue that for development, that at least you don't have to launch anything. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine if you had the resources, there's a lot you could do along that avenue.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. I mean, you could build a basic cluster of computers. It could have 3 or 4 computers or Raspberry Pis connected up, running essentially a cluster of computers which parallel processes a problem that you numerically coded up. And you could look at navigation problems, because there's a lot of codes which do exist, which are developed, you know, by the space agencies and by the academic institutions. But they're not necessarily geared towards interstellar space flight. And so they're more interplanetary. The consideration for interstellar is not even on the radar. It may, for some of them, not take an enormous amount of effort to bespoke them towards the interstellar focus, but certainly we would like to develop some in-house code. And I've developed lots of ones myself, but they're certainly not up to the standard ready to be open source or anything like that. But if we had resources, we would like to do that.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for your answers.
Thank you, Kim. Listeners, if you want to give us a call or send us an email, there is still time. It is 1-866-687-7223. And email Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And does the interstellar interest help in getting younger school kids interested in space?
Oh, yes, they love it. In fact, one of the things we're looking forward to doing is getting some school tours to come over and look at our HQ, because we have so many space models from, the space shuttle to the V2 to Skylon to, as I mentioned, some of the biggest things like Star Trek Starship, Babylon 5 space station, huge model of the ISS, Saturn V. Got lots of cool paintings, and we're actually going to create stuff for them to do as well so they can come and interact, so we can maybe give them a couple of short lectures and give them a problem to solve. We've got two big blackboards so we can get them actually trying to solve some problems. And in fact, we in our education committee, we do work with schools. John Davis recently ran something called the Interstellar Challenge with, I think it was the Imperial College, and it might have been the Institute of Physics or one of the other institutes in London. I forget which one it was. But they run this very successful Interstellar Challenge for a day where they give students a problem, and which is related to the Tsiolkovsky rocket equation. They have to try and solve it. And so we do work with students. We have some young people in our team. Kieran Thwaites is one of our youngest. He's a what I call a young whippersnapper, a future Zephyrin Cochrane, who will probably prove me wrong and invent the warp drive at some point. I hope he does. And we do encourage them. Actually, the youngest member of our team is my daughter, Amelia. She's only three. My other daughter, Jemima, who's only 5 months, hasn't joined the institute yet, but her name is on the to-do list. So we are keen to bring children into this vision because, you know, in particular, the most important years of development for a child is probably the first 7 years. And if we could fire them up with this sort of this vision of thinking about space and going to the stars and maybe meeting, you know, ETs and visiting other planets, it's very exciting. And hopefully they'll take that through their education, through school and through college and university, and maintain that interest. And that's what we really try to do, is try and keep that connection and keep them inspired. And hopefully when they grow up to become professional artists or architects or whatever it is they do, engineers, they will somehow find a way to carry on using that knowledge to help us move forward. So we are about engagement throughout all of the disciplines and all of the age groups, and there is literally no limitation in age or any other category of involvement with our organization.
Larry is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, as part of your work and your vision, are you engaged in or do you pay attention to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence? Do you get involved in any of those efforts?
So you can't be involved in Interstellar and not be interested in the problem of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I mean, it's a very interesting philosophical discussion, and everyone in our team has different views about you know, what the situation is, what's the solution to the Fermi paradox. I mean, my argument is that, first of all, the Fermi paradox is poorly framed, I think. It's, you know, based on a calculation from Enrico Fermi in the 1950s over coffee lunch, apparently. But to me, it's basically, there's a theoretical prediction for intelligent life in the universe, which is based upon, you know, the number of stars, the number of planets, the distances between them, how long it takes for life to evolve, how long a civilization exists. How do we know that? How do you know how long a civilization exists? We've got one example to prove it. And then there's the observations, what we can observe with our radio telescopes and our optical telescopes and everything else. And there seems to be a contradiction between those two methods of thought. And that, for me, is essentially how I reframe the paradox of the contradiction in our thinking. And now, actually, I think both of them are wrong. I think the measurements are wrong because we apply bias to our observations of what we're looking at. And actually, for example, there are science requires reproducibility, but actually there's lots of interesting data out there where there's only been one signal. We're aware of the famous 1970s WOW signal. There's lots of other signals in literature, which Carl Sagan was one of the first people to write about, which shows that there's lots of interesting things happening out there. We don't know what they are. They could be astronomical. They could be industrial. We don't know. And I'm interested in, you know, people like Bob Zubin have published some papers looking at whether you could generate energy emissions from a fusion engine or an antimatter reaction, for example, which is consistent with some of those energy signatures. So I'm interested in that element. But I do think we apply I think it was Arthur Eddington who said that, you know, we see a carving. We see like a piece of wood, for example. We want to carve a horse, and therefore we make a horse. But actually that might not be how nature works. That might not be what we're seeing. It's just what we choose to see. And similarly, with our expectations, I mean, our expectations and how we calculate the probability of life in the universe, the Drake equation, is a wonderful tool for thinking about the problem, but it's deficit in many ways, such as, for example, it doesn't take account of interstellar migration or the idea that life could actually evolve independent of a biosphere, that life actually could start in space itself. So there's lots of things that are missing, I think, from the current approaches to SETI. And I think we need to broaden that spectrum of thought. There's ideas for search for extraterrestrial artifacts. A friend of mine in Australia, Adam Crow, was once asked in San Diego, if he was to do one thing, what would he look for? He said dead starships. I really like that idea, that you'd look for starships that tried to make the crossing, they never succeeded. So I think we need to broaden our thought, also about what is intelligence and what is life. We think about definitions of life as being based on the ability to locomote and to procreate, et cetera, which you can find in any standard textbook. We used to think that photosynthesis was very important for all animals. Of course, now we know there are animals that live at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Similar things might be at the bottom of the ocean of Europa around Jupiter, based on the tidal forces of the gravitational attraction of Jupiter and how this produces these resonances and the volcanism at the surface. So there's lots of ideas about what life is, but actually there was a famous book, I forget when it was written, by the physicist Erwin Schrödinger called What is Life? And I recommend anyone to read it. And he had a different definition for life, which was life is the resisting the decay to thermodynamic equilibrium. So I think that's really interesting and insightful. And I tend to think he's onto something. And, of course, Erwin Schrödinger also potentially predicted the DNA molecule before anybody else. He called it something else. I can't remember what he called it, but he essentially predicted it. So he's a very smart guy. And I think we need to broaden our understanding and our definitions of what life is, what is intelligence. Everyone's obsessed with IQ quotient. I don't give any credence to IQ whatsoever. My mother, who's not passed any IQ test, but she solved many problems in her life, which I would say she was a genius. So, you know, we need to rethink what is intelligence. And there's some great lectures on TEDx by, I forget his name, he's got the biggest ever TEDx following. I forget his name. Do you know his name?
No, I don't know which one you're talking about.
He talks about creativity in schools and things like that. Ken Robinson. Sir Ken Robinson. I really recommend his TEDx talks. And he talks about, we need to rethink intelligence. And we need to rethink how we are essentially educating children out of creativity. And he's absolutely right. And, of course, Albert Einstein used to say that it was really a child who was still asking the child questions like, what is it like to ride a beam of light through the universe? We don't ask those questions anymore because we fear ridicule. We fear that we're wrong. What is wrong with being wrong? Being wrong is how we learn. Being wrong is how we evolve. And I would like to re-debate all of those things. What is life? What is intelligence? How are we calculating what is the probability of life in the galaxy? And we would still produce a spectrum of answers, and the answer will still be we don't know. But until we have those sorts of broad philosophical discussions, which encompasses all of the disciplines of thought, not just, say, astronomy, then we're never going to really know. And, of course, the best way to know is to build the big telescopes to see as much as we can see, to detect the methane and the other industrial sources on planets, but also to send spacecraft that go out there and do in-situ reconnaissance. That's the only way we're really going to know. And hopefully we'll find E.T. there to greet us and welcome us to the collective club.
I have time for one more email that came in. Ben is in Chicago, and he says, I can't imagine an interstellar discussion without checking with you on your belief for the possibility of time travel. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it depends on, it's a bit of a loaded question, because, of course, what do we mean by time travel? There's various versions of time travel. We know that time dilation happens in relativity. And, if people may not know, they may not realize, but actually we're all traveling at the speed of light through the four dimensions of space and time. So you've got time and you've got the three dimensions of space. Essentially, if you accelerate all of your motion, all of your motion is moving through the space dimension, then your motion through the time dimension goes to zero. Time slows down. And that's essentially what happens to the speed of light. Of course, photons don't experience, in inverted commas, time because they are traveling. across the universe at the fastest possible speed through all of the dimensions of space, all the motions for the dimensions of space. So they don't experience time as such. So there is versions of time travel. And we know about the time dilation effect. We know that if two brothers are the same age and one goes off in a rocket ship at a certain speed and comes back, that there will be a difference. We know that every time we go in a jet airline or fly across the Atlantic, there's a tiny difference which is measurable. And it's, you know, satellites depend on that time dilation effect in the GPS. So there's that sort of time travel which does exist. Now, in terms of time travel Doctor Who style, which I believe is what he's probably referring to, using something like a TARDIS, I mean, I'm not going to rule it out, but if you look at things like entropy and thermodynamics, it suggests to me that the idea of going backwards in time to change the past is incredibly difficult, and the laws of physics may not allow it. But my perspective at the moment is I don't see any evidence that is the case. There's an interesting film, Interstellar, which you've all hopefully seen. Everyone who's listening to call has hopefully seen. But I was actually watching a really interesting YouTube video the other day talking about something that's not been discussed in the film. Everyone talks about the science, which is the link between love and time. Because in the film, one of the premises when the astronaut goes off and he's losing the connection with his daughter is the thing that binds them is love. The love is able to travel through the dimensions of time in the film. And I like the idea of that, that there are some things which can transcend time. And, of course, when we lose our loved ones, we still love them. The love still exists. And, you know, and there's a future. So what can exist in the future? So I actually think that probably our understanding of time is profoundly wrong. And I haven't got time to go into it today, but I think actually the fundamental problem with the contradiction between quantum mechanics and general relativity, I believe, is due to time, our misunderstanding of time. And, you know, I think that we tend to think linearly. We tend to think that things move and progress in a certain way. And that we think that because of thermodynamics and the way that entropy unfolds and gravity, the way gravity works. But there are contradictions even in cosmological models, even in the Big Bang model, which suggests that our understanding is not correct. So, you know, I don't see any evidence that someone's flying around in a TARDIS, like Doctor Who is able to change the time at the moment. But general relativity certainly teaches us that time is just another dimension in the tensor manifold, if you like, in a way that space is. So who am I to say? I mean, I'm somebody at the outset of this century. In the future, who knows what's possible? And of course, time, assumingly, is some construct of this universe. And of course, there's many universes. What does time mean then? Was there a beginning to the Big Bang? I don't think there was. I haven't got time to go into that today. It's a cosmological argument. So, you know, if the universe has always existed, what does time mean in that context, in the greater context of a multiverse? So I don't know if I've answered the caller's question, but I think it's a really interesting topic.
Closing comments, anything you would like to leave us with for today?
Well, I'd really like to say that, you know, our HQ is in Gloucestershire, and just about 30 minutes outside of Bristol. Bristol Airport's the nearest airport. Anyone that comes to England that wants to visit, you just get in touch with our team. We will gladly show you our facility. And if you wanted to give a lecture to our team, come and give a lecture, and we'll make sure we arrange it. We are going to start uploading our talks. Once we do lectures, we're going to put them online, and some of them live so people can see them. And this is really a space to kind of meet and think about focusing on the interstellar vision, getting organized as an organization and as a community on the R&D and what's important. It's about building credibility so that, you know, when people see we're doing interstellar, they don't just think we're a bunch of people in a garden shed, to use the famous phrase people often say about English bossings, building rockets in their garden shed. We actually have a building, and we actually are doing serious research. We're publishing papers. We're organizing conferences. And we are talking to real space designers who build missions, and some of them are in our team. We're trying to capture all the knowledge. We're trying to build assets. We have an investment portfolio. That's the other thing. If you look at the history of some of the biggest organizations in the world, like the biggest companies that existed for hundreds of years, or the churches, for example, one of the things they had in common is assets. What's the assets of the interstellar community? You can't move forward if you don't have a safety net of assets to build from. You need to generate wealth, which can look after the teams, look after the people, and move the project forward. So that's one of the things we're focused on, is wealth generation. And so our team is very important to us. Every member is very special, but also everyone in the community. So if you want to come over to HQ, Starship Central Earth, and get talking to us, get involved with I4S. We're about to launch our membership scheme. We've been probably about a month or so, online membership, so anyone can join the organization and be a part of our journey. And that's it, really. Just keep looking up at the stars. And don't forget, it's 40 years since the Voyager probes. Have a think about where we're going to be in another 40 years from now. If you look at the politics on the television, it kind of looks a bit daunting and scary. But human beings have overcome great obstacles in our history, and I think we will overcome whatever's coming next, and we can think about what's ahead of us in the next 40 years. And hopefully, not only can we see those planets around other stars, but we would know that there's civilizations out there. That's my hope within my lifetime, and we send space probes on their way to greet them. That's my kind of vision for the future.
And that's a great way to bring the program to a close today. And Kelvin, thanks for updating us and sharing all this great information with us and your plans for your new headquarters, which we will definitely be following and talking to you about in the future. It's really exciting, and we love this field, and we just can't get enough of it, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again down the road.
Well, thanks, David. It's been great coming on the show again, and I shall carry on working on the HQ and building some models. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it. And Friday, Pat Hines with the Personal Spaceflight Symposium is on. Sean Casey is Hotel Mars on the Silicon Valley Space Group. So that is our week. Everybody stay tuned for more. And as Kelvin said, keep looking up. Goodbye from him, myself, and the Space Show.